Session number 3901, reel number 7.
Were you concerned at that time that there might have been a contradiction between training men to be documentary film cameramen, when you yourself believed that a battle cameraman should be trained as a screen journalist, in other words, someone who could work independently and film a story?
Well, no, you see, because what I've said really is, with hindsight, I think at the time when we started training, I'm sure that, you know, we must have discussed it as to what was required. And, you know, we went ahead and did what we thought was right at the time. But, you know, I think one had a sneaking regard, perhaps, that newsreel cameramen would have been the right thing, but one could always be proved wrong. But, again, with hindsight, I don't think I was proved wrong. However, as I say, it's hindsight.
Did you ever make use of the skills of newsreel cameramen?
John Cotter, who got bottled up in Malta, who'd worked for March of Time, was, I think, the only newsreel cameraman who came into the Army Film Minute. The rest of the newsreel cameramen would have been, I think, reserved occupation, or, you know, and they would have been on the scene, perhaps as a war correspondent, but the Army Film Unit never had their services.
Did you consciously train your men to film differently to the Israel cameramen?
No, because not consciously, but you know, as I say, I think that a screen journalist is an animal, if you like, a very peculiar animal on his own. He can either do it or he can't do it. He can get, he can be proficient, I suppose, and turn in a story which is adequate, or he can be brilliant. But I think that this is a natural talent. And it isn't one that's really taught. It's to be able to go right to the heart of the story immediately and cover it with a minimum of fuss, and if you like, footage, and it still be there. This, I don't think we did ourselves. We would have produced, you know, many thousands of feet. And I know from my own experience, being on a story alongside newsreel cameramen and seeing their work in the War Office Theatre and seeing my own. And, you know, I must be honest, they had the story, I didn't.
At the end of the training course, how were people selected?
I can't answer that question because we would pass them out. I mean, I passed them out of the training course or rejected them. They were then, as it were, selected again in the only instance that I know, they were selected by Hugh Stewart together with other officers who were going to go to the North African campaign.
Did you ever openly disagree with Hugh Stewart over matters of selection?
Yes, I think I did. One particular case, after all, I'd worked with these men for five weeks, and, you know, I think I knew their capabilities, and in one particular case, I might as well give his name, Ben Weinreb, who'd gone through the course, and I would have put him fairly near the top of the class, was rejected on a 2-minute interview. Why, I don't, you know, I can't, and I didn't, you know, have a disagreement about that. I think there were probably two others, but the Ben Widerib thing I was, you know, very, very annoyed about.
Did you remain in charge of training after that?
No. Whether it was because, if you like, I've made myself unpleasant, or whether it was just because, in fact, training was discontinued. It may well be that training was discontinued because training didn't start, I don't think, for some time after that, the first course. I think the second and third courses were... the second course, I think, it was probably some six to 9 months later. Again, I'm not really sure.
Was that by the time the training course had moved to Pinewood?
Yes, it was. We moved to Pinewood not very long after the second training, not very long after the first training course. It was. We weren't at Curzon Street very long. I think we were only there about 6 to 9 months, I think. And then the unit moved down to Pinewood, and we started making films.
But by the time it moved to Pinewood, your connection with the training
had ceased. Whether it was because there weren't training courses, or whether, you know, I'd blotted my copybook, I don't know. Can't remember.
During the period at Curzon Street, what contact had you had with Major McDonald?
I'm sure, I imagine he was about. Again, my memory is very weak on this. I think sometime probably during the time we were at Curzon Street, he might have gone out to Egypt to plan Desert Victory, in which case I think... I would have been answerable then, probably, to Alec Bryce, who I know did take over for a time, and then Alec Bryce went, and I know Alec Bryce was certainly down at Pinewood in charge of the unit for a little while. I'm not sure how long, but he was.
But as far as you can remember, McDonald had nothing to do with the training side.
I don't think he did. I don't think he did. I think he obviously would have been in on the initial, initial idea of setting the course up, obviously, and I imagine we must have discussed what we were going to do with him. I'm sure we did, but my memory is very faulty on this.
Did you have much administrative work to do?
No, not really. No. That was one of the blessings in Army film unit. There was very little administrative work to do. I mean, we did have administrative officers, but that was when we moved to Pinewood and became a bigger unit.
Was the notion of a course for training cameramen novel at that time?
I think so. At least. From my point of view, it was, although there had been a course at the Regent Street Poly, which was, I think it was a 3-year course. I'm not quite sure when it finished, but I think it finished probably 2 or 3 years before the war. And to my knowledge, none of the people who took the course, ever finished up in films. So, in one respect, I suppose ours was a novel course, and the training we gave was based on the experience, if you like, that I and presumably Bill Allen had got when we both went into the film industry, and we telescoped it down, taking the bare essentials and putting the bare essentials across, and so the cameramen were equipped with the bare essentials, and we hope that the experience they gained in the field, or, you know, on the road or whatever, would make them into better care of men still. But the unfortunate thing, of course, is they did very rarely saw their own work.
What did you do after you left Curzon Street?
We moved to Pinewood, and then I started making, you know, photographing films then. I think the first film I went on to was People's Army, which was being directed by Gerald Keane. He'd already started shooting it, and I'd probably taken over as cameraman from Harry Rignall. Harry had gone presumably to North Africa, and I took over from Harry. And then the filming we did was in the New Forest area. I know we were based at New Milton for a period, and our lead actor was Jimmy Handley, who was a professional actor in the army, and he'd been commissioned. I think he'd been one of the rank starlets. And that's an unfortunate word to use for a man, but you know, he'd been in the rank acting school as a juvenile lead, and he took a part in the People's Army, and then I think the troops we were using, which were the Staffords, went to North Africa, and I think took a tremendous caning, and it was decided to shelve the People's Army film altogether because of offending widows. And
had it reached the cutting?
No, it hadn't. No, my memory is very hazy on this, but I don't know if we were halfway through, three-quarters of the way through, or what. I think we were probably about halfway through. I've got still pictures of various things, you know, various phases. I'm very vague onto how far we'd got. Because Gerald Keane himself, I know, left us. He went out somewhere, and he was killed.
What type of film was People's Army?
It was a dramatised documentary using professional soldiers, of course, as well as Jimmy Handley, who was a soldier but an actor. And I think we also used one or two other actors, but again, I can't really remember. And as to the story, I'm sorry, I can't tell you. I've forgotten. Even if I ever had a script.
Was the title remarkable?
I suppose it was. It was. It demonstrated, if you like, the complete change of mood in England in 1942.
You afterwards made three short films produced by the Army Film Unit and later distributed by the MOI: Man Wounded, Date with a Tank, and Street Fighting. Can you say something about the production of these three films?
Man Wounded, I know we did most of the work somewhere up in the in the Yorkshire Moor area. I know that we travelled up to, it was near, somewhere near Filey, I know that, because we, on our way up, we stayed in an RAF mess at Filey, where Donald Bull, who'd written the script for Man Wounded, and also was directing the film, had a brother who was in the RAF as the dental officer at the camp. So I know we stayed the night at Filey, and then went on to the Yorkshire Moors somewhere, exactly where I can't really remember. We all the staged filming was done there. And this was intercut with material which had come from the various battlefronts, North Africa and the desert.
The scenes looking like the desert were in fact shot at Frensham Ponds.
Oh, that's correct. That's right. We did in fact also go to Frensham Ponds. I'd forgotten about that. I've known that from well before the war as a location for filming of desert material. We filmed there before on many things in my civilian life.
And you also used the wadi at Pinewood in the opening sequence of the film.
That's correct. The wadi was in fact dug for Desert Victory. Then after that we did Date with a Tank, which again was another film which was written by Donald Ball and directed by him. And we filmed at Pinewood on that, and we went all round the various factories and foundries that were making the various bits and pieces that went up to make the 17-pounder gun. In fact, it was a film about the 17-pounder anti-tank gun. And we went to Grantham. We went to English Steel at Sheffield. We went to Patricroft in Manchester. One other factory. Newark, I think it was. That's right, Newark.
When you saw the film recently, you said you were surprised by how much material had been left out.
Yes. Well, I suppose I can remember going through all the, you know, we in fact went through every single stage of the making of all the various bits that went into making the gun. Right from the ingot right the way through to the final rifling of the barrel, if in fact it was rifled. But I can remember, you know, going through all this, and we also did filming. We brought some of the women who worked at the Patricroft factory up in Manchester. We brought them down to Pinewood for some of the scenes that we want. I think that were supposed to be in the canteen. I think. Again, my memory is terribly hazy on this, but I can remember them coming down, and I can remember the way they in fact behaved towards all the troops. They were absolutely wonderful people.
Did the Ministry of Information take any interest in the film at this time, as far as you were aware?
I don't believe they did. I think the interest might have been purely in the script and not in the actual material. After all, we were professional filmmakers, and I assume they relied on the fact that as we were professional filmmakers, we knew what we were doing once they'd agreed to the script. But again, I mean, I imagine probably Donald Ball might be able to straighten my story up for me. Then after that, we worked on a film called Street Fighting, and having now seen the film, I realised we used one of the guards. Battalions to do the street fighting for us, and this was done in Battersea. It was somewhere near the Battersea Dogs Home. It was an area which had been very heavily blitzed. There were streets of empty houses, or and most of them very badly damaged. It was shot in the summer, I can remember that. And I can remember we used to get absolutely filthy dirty with all the dust and rubble about.
Were you filming from entirely exposed positions, or did you try to recreate what you thought were the actual conditions cameramen would face?
Oh no, we were filming from exposed positions. It was done, if you like, in a kind of a dramatized documentary fashion, you couldn't make a film adequately from hidden positions, really. Your view would be much too limited, and it'd be very inhibiting for any film director to try and make a dramatized documentary under those kind of conditions.
Can you recall the shooting of Desert Victory?
Oh, very well, because I was at Pinewood when they were doing a tremendous amount of the material. Although I didn't film it myself, Glendenning did the filming. The night barrage, that was in fact filmed in the Pinewood grounds. Perhaps not 100%, but at least I would have thought about 95% of it was filmed in the Pinewood grounds. We had 25-pounder guns firing blanks. We had camouflage netting over them and things like that. There was the wadi, of course, which was dug especially for Desert Victory. The scenes where they put the tapes down to go through the minefields, that was filmed in the studio. If I remember rightly, Paul Fletcher looks at his watch in the film and you see him shout charge or forward or fire or whatever it is. That's certainly Paul Fletcher. The Scots going forward in night, that was certainly shot down at Pinewood in the studios, going through the white tapes.
Were these real troops from a Scottish regiment?
Oh yes. There was I think the only actor in that, and he in fact was a brigadier anyway, and that was Leo Genn. I think he was a brigadier or a colonel. I think Leo Genn did appear in Desert Victory, but I mean, you know, he was a field officer anyway. it wasn't cheating at all. He was a genuine soldier and a genuine officer. The stuff shot at Pinewood, together with the stuff shot behind the lines, staged behind the lines, makes up a very large percentage of Desert Victory. If one examines it very carefully, you know, and examines it logically, you'll find that this is so. And you'll also find that that in many instances, you'd have to probably go back to the original negative to make to verify this, but there will be what we call optical flipovers, because, if you like, one of the scenes which the editor wants, he wants it to go from right to left, but in fact all he's got is it going from left to right, and so he just turns it over. And as we were using the cameras in the the battle cameramen's cameras were full gate, and so this is quite possible without any loss. I think I'm correct in saying that they were full gate cameras. I don't think they had soundtrack cut off. There might have been soundtrack cut off on the viewfinder, but not on the actual camera gate. Also, every now and again you'll notice that a scene will perhaps lack critical focus, and this is because it's been flipped over. And unless this is done, the flip over is done optically, so that in fact you alter the focus on the optical printer, you're out of register. But you can get it back into register by putting it through the optical printer. This is the only way that can be done. Perhaps the thing I should talk about is when we'd finished the film, Desert Victory, it was decided that there should be a special prologue to go with the film to the States. And Winston Churchill this time was recovering from one of his many bouts of pneumonia. He was down at Chequers, and he had agreed that he would speak the prologue. And I think the unit was called, the unit call was to be at Chequers at 10:30. They went down to Chequers. Dave MacDonald, who at that time was a lieutenant colonel, with Bolting, who was a captain, the sound crew, which I think it was Peter Hanford, was the recordist. I expect D.P. Field was with them. The boom operator was a chap called George Kroll. The sound camera operator was I forgot what his name, proper name was, but he was known to us as Skimble. The camera crew, I think, was Glenn Denning, with, I can't remember who else was with him, but I can remember them coming back with the most wonderful story. Winston Churchill eventually appeared at 2:30 after lunch. And sat at his desk. He was in a rather bad temper, and immediately he sat down, he proceeded to get on with his speech before anybody had a chance to do anything. Well, they stopped him just asked him if they could have a level, and he wasn't really sure what a level was, but Dave MacDonald explained to him what they wanted, and that was done, and they did a take. And after the take, Winston said to Dave, well, that's all right. So Dave, who is a very diplomatic man, said, well, sir, we'd like another take.